Okay, I'd like to preface my talk by addressing something that Calvin Shipaw said earlier today. He said that molecular manufacturing would be very complex to develop. I've been studying it part-time for 16 years and more or less full-time for 4 years, and looked at every part of it that we can think of from end to end, and I do not see anything complex. There are a lot of complications that will require engineering, but in the sense of complex systems, there's nothing complex in molecular manufacturing in the way of building a tabletop nanofactory. So I will unapologetically give my talk assuming that that is A, developable, and B, can be developed reasonably quickly on the order of computer software, not on the order of evolving a new life form or figuring out new physics, because there is not new physics, it's simply new applications of well-known physics and chemistry. Okay, I have a lot to get through, so I will talk quickly. Molecular manufacturing... Molecular manufacturing involves digital control of chemistry and structure, which means you get very rapid design. You can do engineering rather than guessing or alchemy, as we see in much of today's medicine and some of today's agriculture and even engineering. Local manufacturing from local materials, very, very portable. High-performance products, also high-performance factories, very small. One implication of this is that the factories will be very easy to smuggle. Exponential manufacturing means when you have one factory, you can a day later have two, and a week later have 100, and a month later have as many as you want. This means that the factories become as cheap as any product, because you don't pay by the feature, you pay by the pound. The only cost for a feature is to design it. Products become as cheap as raw materials. That is, as cheap to build, not necessarily to buy. The owners of the factories will presumably want to take a profit to recover costs for developing the factories. Several other reasons for restrictions. But the construction cost, the incremental cost of building a product, will probably be on the order of $1 a pound. Okay, there are at least 10 major classes of effects, and I'm going to have a slide on each of these, hopefully in the next 20 minutes. So I'm just going to go through them very quickly. The effects of all of those, by the way, are interconnected. You cannot look at them one at a time. Within months, a nanofactory infrastructure could become the dominant manufacturing system. You could have more manufacturing capacity than in all the factories of the world combined. You could certainly build more computers in a month than all of the computers in the world combined today. And, of course, with products being easy to engineer, you could rapidly take over things like microphones, cameras, chairs, buildings, cars, you name it. And carbon is flexible enough that it should be useful to build just about anything that's manufactured today. There are a few exceptions, but they're actually hard to think of. Cheap solar power, including storage. This means no more burning fossil fuels for electricity generation. And with a few little wrinkles, no more burning fossil fuels for transportation either. Inconceivably cheap computers. We cannot picture what we would each do with an Earth simulator and a wristwatch. So it's literally inconceivable how cheap and how powerful the computers will be. I'm sure Microsoft can figure out a way to fill up that memory, but it hasn't happened yet. High-performance avionics and airframes. It looks to me like you could take a briefcase and with only the fuel and aviation hardware that you can put in a briefcase you can lift, you can put a kilogram in orbit. So that implies that it's easy for people to get to space. That implies it's easy for weapons to get to space. Environmental issues. Very efficient manufacturing and products. I talked about that this morning. At least 100 billion people could live sustainably on Earth with less environmental impact than we have today in either the first, I mean, the developed nations or the developing nations. That's at 10 kilowatts apiece, which is about half what Americans use today, but our light bulbs here are about 1% efficient. So, yes, we could put 100 billion people on Earth comfortably, sustainably. But with bad management, if we all submitted to our impulse to be Donald Trump, then 100 million people could despoil the planet rather quickly. The ultimate limit, as I said this morning, is heat pollution. It's very, very hard to get heat off planet. There will be, once this becomes the dominant form of manufacturing, there will be sharp decreases in extraction, transportation, manufacturing, and warehousing, possibly sales as well. Conversely, intellectual property will become increasingly important. Now, intellectual property is a little weird because there's nothing tangible that you can own. It's basically created by policy. And what that policy is varies from place to place, both in theory and in practice. So there are a lot of issues to work out there. There will be a lot of tension between consumers and corporations because the cost of products, the value of products will be about at least 1,000 times the manufacturing cost. Americans seem to be comfortable with about 10 times the manufacturing cost, but I think when it gets to be 1,000 times the manufacturing cost, it'll be very, very hard to make people pay that. And it'll be very, very hard to convince corporations to walk away from that theoretical wealth. Old and new businesses, of course, will be fighting. The steel makers will scream. The trucking industry will scream. Everyone will scream, except for the people in the new businesses who will be making out like bandits. Personally, yes. If we are allowed to have our own personal nanofactories, then we can be self-sufficient. We can go out on the desert, on the ocean, in our personal hydrogen balloon, and we can be fully self-sufficient with a tank of carbon and a file of blueprints. Cost of living may go way down. If you can live completely off-grid, then you don't have to pay anyone for anything. Productivity may go way up because you have completely automated factories and very cheap raw materials and very low incremental costs. But let's not forget the businesses. They will, at least initially and at least officially, own the technology, and there will be some concentration of wealth, probably more so than we see in America today. How much concentration? I don't know. I'm not a sociologist, and I'm not an economist. I wish I were. We will be in a post-manufacture society. Today we are in a post-agrarian society. We managed to make that transition. Today about 1.5% of Americans are involved in growing food, and society did not collapse when that happened, when we went from 80% to 30% to 1.5%. We may have to get by without jobs. We may still have work. We will still have an economy, but we may not have a 9-to-5 job. I don't know what that would look like. Okay. Matter that ought to be near and dear to everyone's heart. Cheap sensors and supercomputers. Scott Mize this morning called for a global nervous system. My question is, who gets to be the brain? There are some advantages to cheap sensors and recorders and video cameras and everything. If a policeman beats up Rodney King again, it'll be on videotape. And it'll be on the news. That's good. However, it depends on who owns the cameras. Okay, cheap infrastructure creation. We just heard a wonderful talk about how poverty can be alleviated. But that's only if it's allowed by policy, or if the policy can be more or less forcibly changed. Both of those are problematic. This technology is powerful enough to inspire lots and lots of restrictions, and I'll be talking about some of the reasons for that in more detail in the next few slides. But basically, there will be a lot of tension between freedom and security. This will raise a lot of security issues, and it's not obvious how to handle those without constraining a lot of things that we think of today as fundamental rights, like privacy. One more human right that's in question, the right to advanced medical care. There are people, for example, in the President's Committee for Bioethics who think that radical life extension should not be allowed. There are other people, including hopefully anyone with aging parents, anyone who themselves is aging, who realizes that this is really a non-starter and a really bad idea to restrict medical care. Granted, life extension creates issues, but anyway, this will be a source of much controversy and howling. Speaking of which, massively parallel sensors improve diagnosis, allow you to know what's going on in your body in a lot more detail, spot problems a lot more quickly, fix them a lot more elegantly. If you remember the flashy technology equals primitive technology from this morning, that's true in medicine as well. Actually cutting someone and making them bleed will soon look as barbaric as, bleeding them. Cheap supercomputers to handle the genome, the proteome, neural debugging and research. Very rapid medical R&D. We may be able to do away with clinical trials. If you can watch someone in detail full time and tell what's going on in their body before it goes seriously wrong, then it may be possible to do individual trials. And if something starts to cause a problem, then you just put in some variation of the Respiracyte program to vacuum it back out of the blood and solve the problem very quickly. Neural connections. Well, with the supercomputers and the massively parallel cell-sized sensors, some form of neural interface looks likely. This is speculative because we don't yet know how neurons work in detail, but we already have monkeys controlling computer cursors with their brains. We will probably see a lot more in that direction. Genome manipulation, a source of controversy and a source of also much medical hope. Augmentation, another source of controversy, and for at least some of us, much hope. New technology issues, things that we can't much access today, but we will be able to. Space, we will be able to access very, very cheaply. This will give us resources. This will give us a place to expand into. When you can fly to space, to orbit or even beyond, for about the cost of a first-class ticket to Europe, then it'll be a lot easier to relieve population pressure, even on the scale of billions of people, if we want to, if they want to. It'll certainly be easier to visit space. And let's not underestimate the value of giving people a chance to look down at our planet. I haven't had the chance to do that myself, but I'm told it's pretty transformative to look at the planet from space and realize just how small it is. I'm looking forward to that. Military and security concerns, of course. Space access, if you can put something up, then you can make it come down pretty quickly, pretty much anywhere. Artificial intelligence is a concern. When we get computers much more powerful than the human brain, it seems likely that we will at least be able to simulate the brain at the neural level. Soon after that, we will be able to debug and improve it. There are more theoretical engineering approaches to AI that I don't know much about, but I'm told by a few of the people working on them that there have been some recent theory breakthroughs that look promising. Intelligence augmentation. Some people think of this as a preferable alternative to AI. I don't know how anything with neurons in the circuit will eventually, in the long run, be able to compete with something without neurons in the circuit. But it not only goes to making things smarter than us, it goes to making us smarter, which is, as I said, a matter of controversy. Transhumanism, Hopefully I'll give Mark Gabuda a heart attack with this one. With massive medical treatments and very rapid medical research, there's no technical reason why we could not become far more capable than we are today. Whether there are social reasons against this, whether those reasons should win, and whether those reasons will win, are all questions that remain to be settled. Not now. Okay. Runaway or uncontrollable systems. Anytime you have a system that can self-improve, you face at least the theoretical risk that it can improve itself to be powerful enough to expand into spaces that it didn't used to own. So this is something that we haven't seen much of today, because any evolutionary system has been constrained by biology. The chemistry has to work underwater, the materials are limited, and the worst thing we face today is Ebola. But when we have mechanical vacuum-filled systems that can be far higher power density, when we have digital evolution rather than biological evolution, and when we combine that with engineering, things might get scary. And I haven't looked into that enough to say much more about it, but it does appear to be something that we may need to look at. Finally, things we haven't thought of yet, and there is literally nothing more I can say about this by definition, except I'm sure there are some. Okay, policing and criminology. Any general-purpose manufacturing system that does not have designed-in restrictions can become a weapons of mass destruction factory. This could be a problem. We do not know how to deal with it. We have never had in history a general-purpose manufacturing technology. The kind of built-in security and restrictions that we've seen in computer software and entertainment files is not nearly good enough. Computer programs have largely given up on trying to use technical means to prevent illicit copying. The DVD encryption was cracked a few years ago, and basically, if we need some restrictions, the commercial field is probably not the right place to be designing them. Spying an attack from small high-performance products could be a real aid to criminals. For example, if you received an anonymous message saying, I have embedded something near your heart and wire, you know, $1,000 to this anonymous Swiss bank account, or I will kill you in an hour, what would you do? What would you do if that became a credible threat? And there's also the problem of very small spying infrastructures watching you type your passwords, watching you do everything else. One major problem with smarter weapons, with smaller, more roboticized, more computerized weapons, is that you can manipulate them at a distance in both time and space. This may make it rather hard to find out who did what, and may make it very easy to be destructive for whatever purpose, including randomness, ego, nihilism. So this is looking like a serious security problem. Of course, the obvious alternative to that is universal surveillance, which is a problem of a different kind. One major issue here that we don't know how to deal with today is cross-border effects. If terrorists halfway around the world can attack us here, well, either we have to police their country or their own country has to police them. And for many countries of the world, neither of these is especially workable. Cross-border policing doesn't work. You get checkpoint syndrome after a very short time. Cross-border military intervention can work if you're willing to be repressive enough, but it's not very popular in today's global civilization, and for good reason. But if you can't do anything cross-border, then the most you can do is hope to influence, and that has its own problems. We've been trying to influence Cuba for decades, and not much has changed. Humans are fragile. Oh, and we also tried to influence Iraq for at least a decade, and not that much changed. Humans are fragile. Humans are basically meat is very easy to destroy. Human institutions are also surprisingly fragile. As we see, one heckler can cause significant problems. In an audience of well-intentioned people, so in a civilization of millions or a global civilization of billions, human institutions are quite fragile. And a small, well-designed or lucky perturbation can cause a flurry of bad policy. This is a vicious cycle. We will see a lot of these. And we had better avoid all of them, because with very powerful technology, it will be very easy to find cliffs to walk off of. Bad policies will not cancel each other out. If you have a policy of oppression and a policy of over-permissiveness, then these will not even out to a nice lifestyle. They will mean that you are both oppressed and at risk. There are three very different kinds of issue that have to be balanced. One is security, where you're trying to prevent bad things from happening, basically dealing with negative-sum things, destructive things. Think policing, military, think honor, duty, tradition, feudalism. Then there's commerce, where you are dealing with positive-sum situations, where interactions are good for both parties. This free market appears to be a very good way of dealing with scarcity. There will be scarcity post-nanotech in heat pollution credits, if nothing else, probably also in desirable land area. Commerce has things like innovation and efficiency. Finally, there's abundance, which is where a good idea can lead to basically unlimited benefit if the more it's allowed to spread. Our current commercial system does not deal with abundance very well. We try to restrict intellectual property. We try to put a monetary value and an ownership label on everything that's invented. This is not the way to maximize the benefit, although it does admittedly increase the amount of invention. But it's likely that we are not finding at the moment the right mix between incentivizing invention and using that invention as far as it can be used. Computers have made copying almost free, too cheap to meter, literally in some cases, and we're not yet using that. Not only these three kinds of issue, but on many scales and between jurisdictions, which adds more problems. As I said, trying to govern or police cross-jurisdictionally does not work. The Internet is a sneak preview of some of these issues, and it has a lot of problems. Imagine if spam was a physical problem, if someone walked up to you and literally slapped advertising flyers on your forehead, and you had to peel them off before you could see again. This is what spam is, and only the fact that it's non-physical makes it at all tolerable. But if you have very small aerospace hardware with lots of small computers in it, you could imagine a flyer that buzzed around just out of reach saying, you know, buy my product, and it would be a massive pain. Imagine something else that attached itself invisibly to your keyboard and monitored all your keystrokes. And that's not even getting into the weapons. Okay, on the big scale, there will be less need for foreign physical resources, and to some extent even less need for foreign intellectual property, perhaps less incentive to protect foreign intellectual property, but lots of incentive to want foreigners to protect yours. There will be better self-sufficiency. This will take a lot of economic pressure off. In Brian's talk, I was very glad to hear the phase transition in governments when economies got good enough. However, there will be less interdependence and trade between nations, which may reduce the incentive not to go to war. If there's no reason, if you don't need a nation as a trading partner, then there's not much economic reason not to just attack them for convenience. Rapid development and deployment of weapons, when engineering becomes easy and you can go from a CAD file, a computerized blueprint, to a full product in an hour or two, and when prototypes cost, you know, 50 cents a pound, then you can develop a new weapon system perhaps in weeks instead of months or years. A simple thing you could develop in days, like computer software. It's worth noting that our computer programs that we develop today and our computer hardware is far more complex than almost all of the physical products that we develop today. So when we become able to apply computer methodologies, at which we're reasonably well trained now, to the development of physical products, including the manufacture, we can expect to see a much more rapid development of products become possible. Unstable arms race. There are several reasons, and I don't have time to list them, but there's about 10 reasons why a nanotech-based arms race looks less stable than a nuclear arms race. Only one of them is that it's really hard to tell who has what. There's a lot of incentive for preemption. Okay, most of these technologies will be very, very desirable, and most of them will be dual use, military and civilian, which means that there will be rapid proliferation. It will be very, very hard to make a case for restricting these technologies entirely, and in the long run, 15 years, it probably will not be possible. Do we need a global administration of some kind, whether the UN, the International Atomic Energy Agency, something we haven't invented yet? It seems likely that we probably will need some kind of global administration. We probably will have to invent it. This takes time. Then implementing it takes time. We may not have that much time. So, remembering again that each of these is very interconnected, we have to recognize the impact of molecular manufacturing on each of these areas, which will take specialized study, detailed in-depth study, and until we know that, we cannot do well-informed scenario planning or policy making in any of the areas, because we won't know what effects the other areas will have on them. And keep in mind that this is just an overview. The alternative to this kind of in-depth study is to accept that there will be drastic change that we cannot predict and we cannot control. That does not sound desirable. Whoops. So, this is me, my email. This is the organization that I co-founded 2 years ago to start to study these problems, and this is the website that I'm now hosting that went online about a month ago, where I'm hoping that that you guys and many more people like you will help me help everyone think about these things, because as I said this morning and as I think I've shown here, it is far too big a job for any single organization. Thank you.